Hello, Marvelites. You're listening to This Week in Marvel, and I'm Ryan Panagos, a.k.a. Agent M.
And I'm Lorraine Sink, agent of Earth X, Paradise X, Marvel's X. Your ex. This Week in Marvel is a podcast where we talk about all things Marvel every single week, except for this week, because we did that on Friday. We're doing a very special episode this week with incredible Marvel creator Alex Ross talking about Marvel's and the Earth X series of comics.
Yeah, this is a big, super special episode because we have Alex Ross, Marvel storyteller, writer, artist, painter, kind of legendary storyteller over the last 25 years. And then we also wanted to talk about some really great comics with him, which I think is especially fun right now for everybody who's at home, who wants some Marvel comics to read while they're, you know, working from home or just hanging out.
I think a lot of people also know Alex Ross from his work on the 1994 series with Kurt Busiek, Marvels. And I think the thing that really sets that story apart for a lot of people and why it's been one of his more iconic parts of his portfolio is that it's really told from a very human perspective. And Alex Ross's art is very important to that perspective because it has a sort of genuine realism to it. It's sort of painterly, it's very realistic, and yet it's very grounded in sort of a traditional Marvel Comics style.
Yeah, the human perspective is so important to the book because Marvel follows this reporter, Phil Sheldon. He's a photographer in New York City, sort of at the onset of the Marvel age of superheroes. So if you think about 1961 time frame in terms of when we started publishing Fantastic Four and then Hulk and X-Men and Spider-Man and everything else, it's Phil Sheldon is on the ground floor of that explosion. But it even goes earlier because he's there at the true dawn of the age of Marvel with the introduction of the Human Torch and Submariner, and it's really cool. But it's all these big events in the Marvel Universe seen through the eyes of you and me.
Marvels has really become such an important part of the Marvel Universe. It really sort of flipped the genre on its head in a way and took the perspective of the average human person in the Marvel Universe and the way that they might view these sort of titans and these huge fights and these epic tales going on around them as they sort of commute to work every day.
But Alex is really fascinating just because he uses real human models for the people that he paints and the way he draws things. He's mixing what he sees in reality and then adding the incredible Marvel universe of it all. So he's taking the experiences that he sees with his eyes right now and the experiences he's seen throughout his life as a Marvel Comics fan and sort of bringing them together with like his kind of unparalleled skill as a painter to bring it all to life.
Alex Ross is truly excellent.
Yeah, there's kind of no one doing what he does at the level he's been doing it for now 25 plus years, which is wild to think about. I can't believe Marvels is over 25 years old now. It feels like yesterday when I first read it, but it's still so fresh and so relevant. And so more recently, he teamed back up with Jim Krueger, who's a writer he's worked on a number of projects with. We're going to talk about them. And new artist Will B to do a sort of almost a merging of Marvels and his other major Marvel project, Earth X, in a series called Marvels X. It has that human perspective because it follows the last boy, the last human on Earth, where everybody else has been mutated into something else. So you get that POV that Marvels has, but it's a prequel to Earth X. And so it's really cool seeing this project come together following what was previously the Earth X trilogy from the late 90s and early 2000s.
Ryan, I think it's so special that you got to talk to Alex Ross because we've never had him on This Week in Marvel. We haven't really had him very much to do any interviews. So this is a really rare, amazing chance to get to hear from a master in the Marvel universe.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to chat with you today for myself and also for our This Week in Marvel listeners. It's an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. What is your Marvel origin story? How did you first get connected to the characters, the stories? Was it a comic book? Was it something else? What got you into Marvel?
Well, one of the things that I've worn out the story of talking about the electric company usage of Spider-Man, that affected pretty much anybody in my generation, kids growing up in the 70s, that here's a show that was part of the block of Children's Television Workshop entertainment on PBS that was raising your kids for you. And so here's a guy wearing the Spider-Man outfit, and that probably would have been the first superhero character I saw. And I was particularly dazzled with the mystery around this character, covered head to toe with no eyesight of, you know, either the mouth, the nose, the eyes, and, you know, just fell in love from that point. And that drove me towards the comic books, which the first one I would be getting would be based upon the way he was presented in the show, the Spidey Super Stories comic book. And then that led to the world of comics and buying them regularly thereafter, whether I was begging for them to be bought for me or I was finally getting my own money, you know, like a dollar a week back in the 1970s, you know.
A dollar a week could, back then, could have gotten you a couple of good books. What else did you start reading after, you know, you got into Spider-Man?
I think, you know, you do kind of go for the main headlights when I had the taste for wanting to know as much as I could. And so the team books were going to draw my attention. So Avengers and Fantastic Four and anything, even like The Inhumans was a series back in the 70s, so I'd be drawn to wanting to know, like, okay, this book has maybe 8 to 10 characters that are featured within the whole lexicon of Marvel, and I want to know who all those people are. But otherwise, I would be buying the lead book characters like Spider-Man, Hulk, Captain America, Iron Man. You know, those are the cornerstones of Marvel Comics.
Yeah, and you could see, you know, in the work that you've done, those characters come up often and again, and they are, they're, as you say, the cornerstones. Your mom was an artist, is that correct?
That's right, yes. She went to the same art school that I went to, and she was doing fashion illustration when I was a teenager. But otherwise, when I was first drawing and getting very driven towards it, I wasn't seeing her working at that point in our history. So really, it was sort of a thing passed on without the example being given to me. It just sort of is a wiring thing.
That's wild. I had thought, you know, maybe you saw her drawing and then picked it up from there. That's pretty cool. At what point did you start drawing where she started to sort of see, oh, my boy has the talent?
Well, you know, a lot of that is not so much about whether or not you do a particularly good drawing. It's just how driven you are to do it all the time. It's how I used to entertain myself. So the way I'd interpret something I was enjoying on television is then go and draw it. And seeing the volume of stuff I was making was different than her other children. So I was the caboose kid of four, and I suddenly show that drive that before not so much of the other kids would stick with. And then it sort of revealed very quickly to my mom's senses when I was three that I was very much like her.
From that early age, that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got and because she treated my life like it was something to keep a record of, I've got the boxes still of all my drawings she saved going back to 1973. So I have this record of these incredibly primitive drawings of Spider-Man that I would have been creating at that time.
I love that. Have we done an Alex Ross Marvel art book yet?
Well, yes. Last year, it was actually Random House published a book called Marvelocity that it was a kind of a sequel project to the book I had on my body of work for DC. And that coffee table book came out in 2018 and is available now. And it's got lots of my childhood stuff mixed in with my adult professional stuff to show how this was a relatable, lifelong kind of passion.
Ah, that's incredible. One of the things that I love when I look at the work that you do is seeing the sort of subtle influences of the classics from Marvel, you know, the Kirby, the Ditko, especially now the Immortal Hulk and the cover work that you've been doing there. It feels like it's connected, but it's so you and so cool. Who were some of your biggest artistic influences and some of your favorites?
Well, it's quite a lot, obviously, when you take it all in. But when it relates to Marvel in particular, Kirby's the top of the heap. But you get an artist like me from the stylistic things that broke apart the comics business when you've got Neil Adams bringing in the kind of realism, the dynamic realism he was doing, and then even the slick perfectionism I felt that John Romita represented, Senior, that was a huge influence on me as a kid. But you've got all the painter influences that come to somebody like me, obviously Norman Rockwell, Andrew Loomis, but when it comes also to Marvel again, Marvel was a forerunner in the world of painted comic books, particularly in the 80s, when they started to have more than just one-shot projects, but they had full series. Like, there was a thing that Paul Galassi did called Six from Sirius that was part of the Epic line of books in the 80s, and then eventually the creme de la creme was the 12-issue Moonshadow series done by John Muth. And the fact that there could be that many issues of something that was painted was an eye-opener for me as a teenager to think, oh, maybe this thing I'm starting to learn in painting can apply to the thing that I want to do professionally, and that you can go there. You can actually spend that amount of time. It's feasible to do it.
You mentioned, you know, John J. Muth, and I don't know that readers coming into comics nowadays have that experience of seeing some of that work, especially from that time period, and the Epic line and the graphic novels of the period. We were doing some really cool stuff that hasn't been reprinted in quite a while, if at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you did take in everything that Bill Sienkiewicz did. I mean, he really is the one biggest trailblazer in the field of painted comics becoming more mainstream, because he was pushing for his stuff to be the regular covers of books he worked on, that he would paint them instead of do pen and ink. And then eventually he worked into things like his Daredevil one-shot graphic novel and the Elektra series, both of which he worked on with Frank Miller. Those things being painted was showing that, like, well, why can't you apply that to the mainstream characters? In fact, it seems an odd thing that there would have been painted material in this business without it being fundamentally built upon the most sellable part of the art form, which was superhero characters. And it took somebody like Bill to really put that forth.
100% true. And then Bill takes it to this extreme where his style is so vastly different from everything else you could possibly see. And I feel like that probably worked in his favor of making it bigger and more special and so different.
I've never had this conversation with Bill, particularly to challenge him with this because it's rude to say it, but I always felt like in some ways his influence of Bob Peak that was making his art style as a painter look more kind of stretchy and exaggerated, as well as other influences, I felt like he was almost trying to break away from everybody telling him since he was in his early 20s that he was just a Neil Adams clone. So he was going to try and prove them wrong by just how far he could push things. But he still has that DNA in his drawing style of, you know, the figures having that special Adams kind of quality to them, which I love. But I'm sure it was really annoying for him that he was getting this all the time, apparently.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would love to get into a little bit about your process, because maybe some of our listeners don't know your process and how your paintings come to life. Can you give a little bit of insight into that process?
Well, let's see. I draw very tight layouts, which anybody can get a look at, I'm sure, from images online, like my website, and also the sketchbooks that I produce for San Diego every year show the layouts that I do regularly for stuff. So I really go in there and elaborate this very tight rendered, often tonal drawing, so that the editors I'm working with have no potential of coming up later and say, hey, the sketch didn't look anything like the finish. And I will then shoot photo reference to best match that to, I can follow something that's grounded in reality. Sometimes it's human models, sometimes it's action figures that I'm using as the basis for stuff. I've got 30 years of working in this business now, so I've done it all different ways. And relying exclusively upon my figure drawing skills has not always worked out. That's why I like to look at what the real shape of a hand would do naturally than what my mind thinks it would do. And of course, what lighting and color will tell me from shooting a real object. So once having the photo reference in hand, I've then blown up that drawing to the size of the cover. It's just slightly over twice up the size of the sketch I do to do the final images, and then I will lightbox that, which is basically tracing from the artboard through to the drawing I initially did, trace over my drawing, looking at the photo reference, never tracing the photo reference, because my photos are terrible. They really look ridiculous. I mean, nothing has ever been a perfect match for what you see me draw. And I could point out, shot for shot, of things I've done in the past where the weird exaggerations or twists in forms where I didn't get a likeness right, or I stretched out a human form. That's the revealing hand of how these are being drawn. They're not. There's no tracing of another thing except for my initial layout. Anyway, so then with that tighter pencil done on the board, I go into a gouache painting. Gouache is a form of watercolor that you can work translucently with, which I do, building up layers, possibly going opaque, and that's where gouache is an opaque form of watercolor. It can almost have the appearance in some ways of an oil painting or acrylic. So I do as much of that as a hand-done painting with watercolor brushes on a watercolor paper, Strathmore paper. There's usually a certain amount of airbrush I bring in as a last step. It's almost what I learned from a lot of contemporary artists working with new materials is they might do a painting up to a certain stage in reality and in with physical materials, and then they scan that, and they'll do kind of their cleanup digitally, where they'll put in effects and alter color digitally. And since I'm working without any use of a computer, my mechanical touch-up is using an airbrush, where I will often put a frisket film, which is a tacky film that you stick down onto the surface of your object, cut around figures that you want to avoid getting paint on, and then spray some sort of color to create the illusion of the sky I want, or maybe some other special effect, all these different things. And not every painting I do has airbrush in it. That's not the case, but it's often a last touch step to just sort of put a little, you know, ping on it. And if I can maybe separate the figures I have in a composition from the sky or whatever background so that you get a sense of focus on those central figures, that those are the ones that have brush strokes in them and there's a sense of a hand working on them, I want you to focus on them but not be distracted by the environment behind them necessarily. And that's somewhere where the airbrush helps out. But I'm not mechanically inclined, which is one of the reasons I don't use a computer at all. And when I deal with just the annoyance of having to clear out an airbrush and the spitting that happens from it, I can't imagine dealing with any greater complexity of a machine like that has a mind like a computer does. I have no patience for it.
I fully understand that. But as you tell me the process, like, I have a slight knot in my stomach about the potential for disaster of you're utilizing all the actual physical materials and something goes wrong around you, a beautiful painting you've been working on for, you know, days. Is that's a terrifying prospect in my head and in my stomach.
Well, you know, honestly, in 30 years, there's only been one piece I can recall that about 20 years ago, I spilled syrup on a painting that I was working on, but I was able to resuscitate the piece so that it did not have any remaining damage to it. It was just sort of like enough of a wake-up call of don't eat too close to the artwork, you know. But for the most part, I've been exceptionally lucky, and I don't have all these disasters of things that got destroyed in process of my working on them.
Sure. I'd like to imagine that whomever has that original piece as like a faint, why does this smell like syrup?
Yeah.
you mentioned, you know, in part of your process, your photo reference, you're using either human models or you're using the action figures or whatever you're using for a particular piece. Your friend Mark Braun, I believe, he is modeled for Phil Sheldon, right? For the entirety?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What do your friends and family think about being models for these characters that have shown up for, you know, decades now?
Well, I mean, everybody got a chance in my world to get used at some point or another. I used close friends and family members for so long that it was sort of like community theater amongst all of us you know, getting a shot at being starring in one of my books. But beyond using my father as the main character in one of my more better-known projects, Kingdom Come, I kind of peaked with all that, and now I've got so much leftover photography I can always lean back against and use some of that old stuff. But generally, I use objects more than I use regular people. I've got statues, life-size statues in some case, of things that I can use as model reference, like for Captain America and Iron Man. I like to use people as an immersive experience. It felt like I bonded with reality in a way by using real people, but it's also a giant pain.
I would imagine. You had mentioned you built this Captain America that you used for reference. What is he part of a large collection of comic book and pop culture ephemera that you have? Do you have a big collection being in the business for so long?
Oh yeah. Because the reason I could justify that is that part of the fun of comics is always related to a tactile connection. I feel that some of it is just the toys that we like to get of these things and then, you know, pantomime out adventures with it when we were kids playing with the stuff. But as, of course, I've moved into adulthood with now these objects in my world, either action figures or full-size statues that I've had constructed, it's something that still taps into a sort of gut-level connection to this stuff that I feel is very fun and joyful. It's a positive thing as opposed to like, oh God, what are you doing with your time and money? Why should you want that? Like, because it gives me joy, and I recognize that it gives me joy. So why won't I have a giant Captain America in my house? You know,
yeah, that's great. Yeah, I my collection is my big collecting thing is Godzilla and various kaiju toys and statues, and it's like, of course, this brings me joy. Like you say, you gotta have it. If it helps us, you know, get through some of the rough stuff out there too. Okay, so last year, 2019, 25th anniversary of Marvel's. What memories do you have of its development and creation? You know, is there something that you remember fondly or vividly from that creation?
Well, I mean, you were talking away about the relationship with Mark Brown, and doing that work with him was fun then, because he kind of inhabited, this is a guy I had just met in 1992 when I wound up using him as a model. When I got to be close with this person and using both him and his daughters as the basis for the characters in the story, it grounded the feeling of the book as if it had more importance, as if it was something more real and legitimate. So that was something that was a fond memory to revisit, particularly in using all three of them again, where we're posing for the same characters now, except he's actually now the age that I was up-aging him to be 25 years ago. He looks like the way Phil Sheldon did at the end of the timeline of the original series. So he could dress up as a character and just be that. There you go. That's exactly what Phil Sheldon looked like. And he grew a mustache in so he would look exactly like the character in the book. And ironically, one friend of mine had the hat, which I didn't realize I didn't own, and we had to dig that out. And Mark thought that he had the eye patch, and it turns out I had it in my costume collection of parts and pieces and such. So we dug through all these things and pieced the character back to life. And he, in his own way, became the inspiration for me thinking, well, here's this guy, but I don't know this guy, and I made friends with him, but why don't I make a story about somebody that's very close to me that I always thought would be good as a lead? And that helped to inspire the very notion of creating the Kingdom Come series, where my dad was the main model, because, well, you know, I knew he would be a great lead for a story, and then he was.
What did Mark say when you told him you and Kurt would be revisiting Marvels?
Oh, he's always been very proud of that, in, you know, because he was on the periphery of the comics business. He had worked with the same publisher I had worked with back when I first met him, Now Comics. He had done some stuff with them, and he always had a love for the art form, a lifelong love. And so to be pulled into this world even more with such a project that was as embraced as Marvel's, he was happy for that recognition and that association. And here it is, it's coming back around. And, you know, reminding people of that part that really linked to him. So it was a wonderful thing to be able to revisit it.
I had just reread the epilogue before we started chatting, and I love the connection to X-Men 98, the Claremont and Cockrum issue. Are there any other stories or issues that you two considered as a return to Marvels?
I know that Kurt floated a bunch to me, but I forget at what point I kind of made the sort of pushed him of like, nope, I figured it out. It's going to be this. Because I can be kind of bullish in that way. And I, at whatever point during the year leading up to the story being done, I had just this gut feeling of it should be the new X-Men, which, you know, we're still calling them the new X-Men, the ones from 1975, but that is the way they're viewed. And the oddity of the fact that this was the shift in popular comics going from the primary Silver Age characters that we think of for Marvel to what we would identify as the characters you couldn't get away from because of how popular they were in the 80s and 90s and beyond. And, you know, that's, of course, Claremont's X-Men. So when I would go back in my fandom and think about what I felt when I first saw that stuff in the mid-70s, tapping into the version of the X-Men that did impress me and make me a fan, that was easy and fun to do. I don't know that you would have me paint a lot of stuff of the 90s version of the X-Men.
Oh my gosh, I would be thrilled to see you go full on, like, shoulder pads and pouches with Cable and just go all deep into it. Because, you know, I started reading Marvel in the mid to late 80s, and that the stuff that you're talking about is, you know, you were sort of didn't have as much taste for it was exactly what got me into comics. It's all generational, as we know.
Well, there's also, you know, stylistic changes can often affect the way that you view stuff. Like, you know, I hated those things like the pouches and the exaggerated musculature, because it's not that any single artist was doing that. It's the fact that it became an overwhelming style that now, well, if that was popular here, why don't we hire only artists that do that kind of thing and employ them across the line? It felt like, guys, you know there's such a thing as drawing a thing to look like a thing, right? You know, and so people like me were meant to, the purpose of my career was kind of meant to be a repudiation of what was popular in the time period I entered into.
That kind of feeds into the next series of books I want to talk about, which is the X trilogy, Earth X, Universe X, Paradise X, because you working with Jim Krueger, but also the artists on those books are so far afield from that stuff that was, you know, sort of probably petering out as you guys were developing this. But I recently have gone through and reread the entire trilogy, and it's been so much fun for me because this year we're celebrating the Marvel Omniverse on the show, and it's got so much cool stuff. And I was especially rereading Earth X, and there was like, oh, this concept would then show up, you know, like 10 years later in this book. And then you guys were doing so many things that were so cool and so much fun, and that would later start to like seep into the main Marvel universe. How did Earth X come about?
In the worst way. Well, I mean, the place you used to work at kind of is the origin for it, because after Kingdom Come came out and it was very popular, that initial year, there was so many people reaching out with different things they wanted me to try and do, and Wizard had requested that I do a sort of sketchbook, whatever I could sort of make the time for, that would be of my vision of the Marvel characters done in that future perspective, as I had done with DC. And I just thought, well, that I took it too seriously. I didn't take it in the lighthearted way of what it probably should have been seen as by me, but I'm an uptight guy. So I just, you know, I was like, wow, that's really minimizing, you know, what the thing is. I don't want to exploit Kingdom Come in the way that would demean it and just sort of treat it as a thing that you just copy and blah, blah. You know, I had the wrong attitude at that moment. And like, as long as I had like a year or so to have it sit in my head for a bit and then go, well, wait a minute, what would you do? And initially the only thought was like, you know what, after the age of like 40, Spider-Man is going to be a middle-aged guy who's not going to look great in spandex. So all I could see was a fat Spider-Man. And Eventually, I built off of that. And once I think I hit upon the idea of how the older, scarred Captain America might be, that led to each character I could put my head around and imagine a different sort of twist on their fate. And much of that would always take me back to the original character designs or history to think about what early thing from them should influence or shape them, and often pairing it with a tragedy, which Earth-X was called a very dark vision of the future back when it was done, but it was reflective of a lot of the things that shape Marvel characters, that their storylines have that touch of tragedy worked into them, and that would lead me to all these character reinventions for the sake of what time would do to people. And because I didn't wind up drawing the series itself, I could have a certain disconnect of it wasn't a copy of this other future thing I did for the other company. It was its own animal. And because of the three-part series we did, it had abundant ambition to try and be this Tolkien-esque kind of thing.
With the series being these three parts, going from Earth-X to Universe-X to Paradise-X, was that part of the initial concept that you had, that you wanted it to take this route? Or were you initially just thinking, as you started doing these, that first sketchbook of just the Earth-X?
Of course, just thinking of the Earth-X side of things, just being satisfied enough to hopefully have told one story, like even Kingdom Come was one thing with no grand outreaching intentions to go anywhere else with it. But because Jim Krueger and I had so many extended, inspired ideas that we were building into this, particularly with characters, that we just had no room to get their storylines and their extended worlds into our initial series. The feeling of like, okay, you're kind of casting off those other ideas, putting them aside, they're sitting on a shelf, and now the shelf is getting kind of heavy. And so it wasn't too long before we were saying to each other, we need to have kind of a whole game plan, but not just for a sequel, but we started to envision the idea that this was like a three-part thing for the sake of a sort of biblical allegory, meaning that if you broke down the sort of idea of the end of the world, you have the Book of Revelation kind of guidance point of the war to end all wars, I guess, is kind of the initial one, if I'm getting this right, and then the second thing is the second coming to make a parable for, and that would be the Universe X series. And then the third and final thing would be the war in heaven, the final thing ever talked about in biblical prophecy. That's Paradise X. And, of course, our versions of that are wildly specific to the Marvel lore and not truly getting into theology, but the fact that we established what the afterlife is for Marvel is something that's technically, of course, not canon, but it's also, I don't know if it's actually been followed up by anybody else. Like, I read so many Marvel books, I don't remember at this point if anybody else bothered to kind of go in there and say, oh, well, here's the, I guess I'm waiting for Jason Aaron to come in and do it. You know, he sort of redid the entire history of Marvel with the Celestials in difference to what we did, and maybe his next step is to finally tell everybody, no, this is the official way that the afterlife works for Marvel.
Yeah, we'll see if he's got that one in him. You know, in the three books, you were able to redesign and create looks and really cool things for numerous places and characters. Do you have any favorite of the specific Earth-X, Universe-X, Paradise-X looks for the characters?
I mentioned Cap, and that's one that I felt the most strongly impassioned about because I felt like I was sort of showing the soul of the character in a way by stripping away the costume, but in fact boiling it down to just he's wearing the remnant of a torn flag, and you can still tell by looking at this man that he is Captain America. That was a passionate thing there. There's a lot of throwaway design things that didn't get a lot of attention that were fun to do, like twists on the Avengers where they're all Iron Man costumes, which, you know, we've kind of almost seen that in the films now, but that was built upon the What If comic book series where they did an early issue that had Gil Kane drawing the Avengers going up against the Hulk and all of them are armored, And so I was playing my own twist on that and turned it into a thing that was sort of like, well, these are actually robot stand-ins for the late Avengers who are not going to be in our future because I took this many characters off the board and said, yep, these guys are all dead. Don't know what happened, but they're all gone. And that's kind of building a lot more of the tragedy and the questions about, oh my gosh, what was the past of this future Marvel Universe? What happened to these people? But we, of course, gave that answer over time.
Yeah. I want to make sure we talk about Marvel's X, which is the prequel to the story. How long had you and Jim been thinking about telling this story, you know, the story of David, this human left in, as everybody else seems to be coming along?
Well, basically, since we were working on the last series, we had this thing lingering in mind. It used to be titled History X, which was kind of a reference to the Ed Norton movie American History X. But, you know, here I'm taking advantage of the Marvel's anniversary by just saying, like, what would get more eyes on it? Call it Marvel's X. And, of course, it has a storyline quality that would justify that because you're, again, dealing with a human protagonist that you're going through him to deal with these Marvel characters, but then you're also getting fairly intimate with them because you get to meet Spider-Man and he's already had his identity exposed, but yet he's still running around in the classic costume and his world is upended. He's widowed and he's got a young daughter he's trying to look after, and the whole Spider-Man thing in the crazy New York that's got all these human beings with mutant powers now, it's just all out of whack. It's incredibly dangerous, and he's lost his way, in effect. And we're kind of showing the sort of last look at the Silver Age versions of all these core Marvel characters is what we were after.
Well, you're doing a great job taking advantage of the Marvel's love because we have Marvel coming out as well. So Marvel is a new anthology series that you're curating with a collection of short stories by Adam Hughes, Bill Sienkiewicz, Dan Brereton, Frank Espinoza, Steve Rude, and, you know, like, which is like a murderer's row. How did the project come together, and, you know, why these artists? And
well,
the
when Marvel had approached Kurt and I about doing stuff to celebrate the anniversary, there was various things they floated, and one of them was just an anthology without thinking anything other of it. It just was added to this list of ideas, and then I had to flag that to say, hey, that was my original pitch. I was coming up with what would be evolve into Marvel's was just simply an anthology idea that I came up with when I was 20 that I was hoping to be part of the anthology myself, but not making it a single storyline. I wanted this opportunity for different painters, which was still a brand new kind of novel concept back in 1990, to get a place where they could go and do short stories with the main characters of these companies. And so that pitch, you know, as you know, the rest of the history would evolve into the narrative that Marvel's was, but it still seemed like a good idea on its own, and now we're being given the platform to finally do it after this many years. Of course, Marvel's had other anthologies that have existed in the last 30 years, but this finally is something close to what I was imagining back then. And that's why the first cover that people see will be this Human Torch recreation, because it's relating to the first inspiration I had, which was Marvel Comics number one from 39, trying to connect with that first project and series that launched the whole company.
But you also get to have a story in here. You're working with Steve Darnell to do a Nightmare story, and man, I love Nightmare. What a great design.
Yeah, but you know what was weird about that is that as I had that inspiration going back like a year and a half or whatever ago when we first were starting on it, that I didn't know Nightmare was in everybody else's thoughts and dreams apparently at the same time, because Nightmare, then I see him in the No Road Home series, and I see him showing up in this comic over here and that comic over there, and I'm getting angry at Tom Brevoort with, like, wait a minute, how can you not give us the heads up that he's going to be in all these places? Like, you should have said, like, no, leave the guy alone. He's going to be way too visible. I just wanted to do this thing tapping into one of the early, well, it is the earliest Doctor Strange story, and how creepy he seemed when he's the first villain for Strange, and the first appearances of him that Ditko did, he would barely, or really not show the guy's face. It was mostly in shadow, and, you know, it has this creepy mix with the art style that Ditko was doing then, And I wanted to be somebody kind of translating that for a painterly style, but tapping the Ditko thing. And, well, that's being done everywhere by everybody. I wouldn't be surprised the next Doctor Strange movie he's in there. But, you know, I thought what I was going to be doing would be kind of a singular connection, but turns out it's the most populist thing I could have possibly done.
Look, more people who get excited about Nightmare, the better. All right, last thing, Alex, if you could choose a favorite Marvel alternate reality story, would you be able to pick one?
Oh, boy.
I know. It's a loaded one again.
I should have been prepared for that one. It'd be something from What If, but like, you know, my favorite alternate reality would be the one with Man-Spider that Scott Shaw did, where it was the story of a spider that was bitten by a radioactive human. I got such a kick out of that when I was 8 years old. And so there you go. There's my favorite alternate reality for you.
Let's see if I can convince someone here at Marvel to commission you to do a painting.
Oh, I already did.
You did.
A very cover I did for the Secret Wars series where I did the regular covers just a few years ago. And on that first cover I picked is a recreation of the classic Secret Wars cover from 84. But I put in all these bizarre choices of alternate reality heroes, and tiny within the piece is a little man spider.
So good. So inspired. I love that. Alex, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So as we talked about earlier, we have Marvels, but we also have EarthX. And I went hog wild recently reading every single story in the EarthX, what was originally a trilogy, and now with Marvel's X, it has expanded, but it's really cool. This is Earth 9997, because remember, Earth Prime 616, Earth 9997 is this alternate reality. I wanted to break this down, and Lorraine, you and I talk about this, because it's Alex Ross, who is the co-writer of all these stories, alongside Jim Kruger. For the first story, Earth X, you have artist John Paul Leone, who... It's a beautiful style because it's dark. It's a little scratchy. It is. There's just a like weariness to the art that you feel right away.
So we think of Alex Ross for a lot of people as an artist, but he didn't only work on the art for these.
Not on the interior. So Alex does all the cover art. He does the character designs. And so it even started with an EarthX special edition that was published in November 1997, where they introduced the core characters for the series. Alex had sketches in there. There were descriptions that he wrote, because a lot of the story is coming from Alex's brain alongside Jim Kruger. And so it really started to form up there. But this was 1997. The first proper issue of EarthX wouldn't arrive until January of 1999, and that's a number zero issue. So number zero is like a history of the Marvel Universe. So if you just wanted to get a sense of, hey, what's the history of the Marvel Universe in one issue, boom, EarthX number zero. But it has a big emphasis on why the super characters are on the planet, how the Celestials are involved with everything. And it introduces the main POV character for EarthX, which is X-51, a.k.a. Aaron Stack, a.k.a. Machine Man. And he becomes the new Watcher in this book.
I mean, I think this is a testament of why the series is so interesting, because if you think of Machine Man as a character in the main 616 Marvel Universe, he's somebody who's not necessarily super fond of humanity. You know, he's a robot guy who is right now currently popping up in Iron Man 2020. But, you know, you think of Watchers, they kind of love every part of existence because they have to watch and record everything from the moon, especially our Uatu the Watcher kind of looking over us. So it's kind of an interesting choice to see Machine Man suddenly put in charge of watching over Earth.
And it's interesting, like the take that they have, because remember, this is an alternate universe, so things are a little bit different. The take that they have on Aaron in this one is that he very much wants to hold on to his humanity. And Uatu, the Watcher, is blinded and basically removes Aaron's human skin and form and leaves him as just this like machine man, this cold.
You mean he's a machine man?
Yeah.
And he's a machine man?
Throughout the whole story, you have this sort of underlying thing going on with Machine Man about how he is more than just his components. So you get into the story in the first issue, which is like 20-year gap. You know, think of like any point in current Marvel timeline, 20 years forward, and then everyone on Earth has superpowers. You got to see, like, Luke Cage is a cop. The Avengers are gone. They're replaced by robots. Captain America is a, like, battered shadow of his former self. Black Panther is a literal panther-human hybrid. The villains are all messed up. Hydra in this reality is this nightmarish hive mind alien creature that has taken control of She-Hulk, Sharon Carter, Falcon, and others. There's no proper Red Skull, but there's a telepathic boy named the Skull who wears a like version of the Punisher skull, but it's red, and he is the most powerful telepath. He controls minds an army. He controls as many minds as he can, and he rides into the story riding the hollowed out shell of a MODOK.
A hollowed out shell of a MODOK? Ryan, I know you don't like that.
No, it's a nightmare. In the story, we get to see Skull and Cap, you know, they go at it. We get to see, like, this kid, the Skull, messing with people, and he tells one of his captives, "I'm God." The next panel, Captain America rolls through with his forces, draped in the flag, bald, old, and angry, and he says, "Then I'm Nietzsche." And it's, like, the brainiest, dorkiest, wonderful action moment sort of like sets the tone for what this story is.
And also, if you're not sitting around reading a lot of Nietzsche, let me like just ruin the joke for you. Because Nietzsche says God is dead. So basically when he's saying, "I'm Nietzsche," he's like, "Watch your back."
I'm pretty sure in the most recent translations of Nietzsche's work, it says "watch your back" with a Y-A. All right, let's get back into Earth-X because it's wild. It's striking because there's a lot of really interesting stuff that comes up. And I think this is why I get so excited about it, is because it can kind of be a perfect story for a fan of any type, any kind of story. Like, there's things in Earth-X that ended up showing up in other books, other stories, other comics years down the line. Let's see. Carol Danvers in Earth-X starts calling herself Captain Marvel. We find out that in the appendix to the fifth issue. There's a female Thor. It's not the first time, but still, it's a major component. Ben Grimm and Alicia Masters are married. They're living on Yancey Street. We see that now in the pages of Fantastic Four. Black Bolt sets off a Terrigen bomb, causing latent inhuman genes to be expressed, which would then show up in the main Marvel universe in 2015, 14 or so. Storm and Black Panther rule Wakanda together. Years after this book came out, they were married. There's a ton more too. This book was so fertile.
Ryan, this is literally blowing my mind right now, because if you really look at this, so this book is supposed to be set 20 years in the future. And if you look at this, it really almost lines up perfectly. Not that it was necessarily ever intended to, or even that the creators probably had any idea, but what a like amazing fortuitous moment. Because if you think about it, Carol Danvers did get the flight suit and became Captain Marvel in around 2014, 2013, around in there. Female Thor happened, aka Jane Foster became Thor around 2012. Ben and Alicia just got married. Black Bolt dropped the Terrigen bomb into the New York Harbor and created Ms. Marvel, you know, just like maybe 7 years ago or so. I mean, this is mind-blowing. Plus Storm and Black Panther getting married. This really just feels like such an amazing, incredible psychic moment that so much of this stuff just happened to come to fruition for whatever reason. And almost on the exact timeline that was foretold in the main Marvel universe is wild to me.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see how I don't know that like creators were like pulling from this. It's just they were Kruger and Ross and Paul Leon were just like vibing on some things that got into the DNA of Marvel Comics. It was really neat. But so like the biggest plot that like overarches through Earth-X is that Earth, like many other worlds in this universe, is a womb for a celestial embryo. The Celestials are the big giant space god things, and so they go to planets, they impregnate the planet with a baby celestial and hope that it comes to life. So in issue number X, which, okay, the numbering gets a little confusing. the numbering for the series goes 0, 1 through 12, and then X. So in issue X, which is kind of like the 14th issue, it is a huge war with the Celestials coming back to Earth, and they're battling all of the powered up humans, like the sort of quote unquote inhumanity. But then Galactus shows up and it's like huge and includes an amazing double page spread where Namor rallies all these sea creatures. He's got these airships and everything is battling the Celestials. And Namor says, quote, "I have known vengeance and manipulation all my life. My ancestors cry out for a reckoning from the depths. The sea will be your grave. Imperius Rex." And it's just like the most awesome Namor moment. Yeah, metal, guitars, explosions, fireworks. It rules so hard.
I honestly love this because Namor was such an angst boy from the very beginning. If you go look back at Marvel Comics number one, he's like, "I'm an angry boy who lives in the sea and I'm going to go fight the Earth people."
Yeah. Also in Earth X, half of him is on fire all the time. I'm not going to get into it. You should read the story. But Earth X, spoilers. If you've not read this yet, we're getting into some spoilers. There's a bunch of stuff that we're leaving out, but the story ends where they save the Earth from the Celestials. They clear the decks for numerous subplots, including the Inhuman Royal Family, a new team of X-Men, X-51 with Reed Richards and Captain America, and so much more. It also sets the seeds for the next part of the trilogy, Universe X, by giving us the return of Mar-Vell, aka the original Captain Marvel.
So then, where are we picking up in Universe X?
Universe X picks up 3 years after Earth X number X, and everything gets so much worse.
Oh, good!
We're going to get to the story for in a second. But the story, again, scripted by Jim Kruger, story by Alex Ross and Jim Kruger. Art on this one is by Doug Braithwaite. One important point, it's a little bit longer. So you have the same 0, 1 through 12, X structure, but you get additional one-shot issues fleshing out a whole bunch of side stories. Stuff about Wakanda and them migrating, like the Wakandan citizens migrating, Captain America's final adventure, Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, so many more. And X-51 is no longer the main POV character. It shifts over to two former defenders, Nighthawk and Gargoyle. And in this new reality, Nighthawk has these magical eyes that allow him to be kind of the watcher. He can see things across space and time, and Gargoyle chronicles everything that Nighthawk sees. So it shifts around, but all the characters from the first one are still there.
Man, how unfair to be the guy that has to chronicle everything that somebody with cool magical eyes gets to see. How rude. Oh, what are you seeing? Is it cool? Okay, I guess I'll write it down.
And the two of them, man, this is so, like, Universe X is like Depression City. It is real intense. There's a lot of terrible stuff that happens, but it's a great read. So the celestial embryo in the Earth has died, right? So that has then messed with the vibranium in the Earth, which has then messed up the polarity of the planet, and Earth is now dying. That's the beginning.
How fun!
Right? Thankfully, Reed Richards and other heroes are trying to save the planet. They are building these big human torches across the world to burn out the Terrigen mists. Their goal is to reverse humanity's mutations, but the torches are under constant attack because imagine, Lorraine, you and I got superpowers in this new Earth and we could fly and shoot like pizza out of our eyeballs or whatever it is.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds delicious.
And then someone was like, "Hey, we're going to turn this off so you can't do that."
No.
Wouldn't you be like, "No, I want to shoot pizza out of my eyeballs."
Of course I want to shoot pizza out of my eyeballs. Come on now.
So I mentioned Captain Marvel, Mar-Vell, has returned. He's returned, reborn as a child, like a tiny, probably about a year old. Like, that's the way he looks as he's drawn in the series. And he's sort of a universal savior. And he's on a quest to gather powerful items in order to, of course, he's going to kill death.
So Q-Lo Baby is on his way to go kill death.
Yep. But he's got his, like, he's got full consciousness. So if Earth-X was a lot about the humanity changing and defying its role that was sort of thrust upon it, Earth-X goes deeper into the nature of reality. It like digs into and shows a little bit of the Marvel multiverse, or the Omniverse, as they call it throughout the series, which I think is an important point for us to talk about it in This Week of Marvel this year. So we see Days of Future Past, we see the MC2, we see Killraven and more. It gets really big and trippy at times, which makes it a whole lot of fun, honestly. And it ends with Earth saved, the decks are cleared again, the afterlife version of Thanos destroys death with the ultimate nullifier. So people are dying, going to this afterlife, and Thanos is sort of like resigned to trying to get on board with Captain Marvel's plan. So he takes the ultimate nullifier. He kills death. That lets Mar-Vell build what he calls heaven, aka paradise, which leads us to the third part.
Yeah, what a great segue to Paradise X. Where do we pick up in Paradise X? Because I'm going to be honest, none of this sounds like paradise so far. Sounds like not paradise.
It just gets wilder from here. Like, let's just dig into it. So the other series begin with number zero issues. Paradise X begins with a prelude series called Paradise X Heralds. This is also, again, by Jim Kruger, Alex Ross, and it has art in this one by Steve Pugh. This series posits that all the alternate realities in the Omniverse were created by Mephisto in his manipulations of time and diverging paths, as we see in Universe X. So it's like Ross and Kruger and company saying, this is how the multiverse works. And it's wild because we get to see a whole bunch of alternate reality characters brought into things like Days of Future Past. Wolverine plays a big part in things. So then we go from Heralds to number zero, where you have Kruger, Ross, and Brett White coming back to do a basically a recap of everything that's happened in the other two series, along with details of what's happened, because a year has passed since the events of Universe X. So we look at Earth. Now, death is gone, so no one can actually die. They just languish and they suffer, and they have open wounds and maladies, and there's like panels of people being like, please just kill me, like I don't like this. And it's really nasty. So it's like this consequence of killing death is just horror. It's horror.
So what you're saying is that essentially everybody is feeling exactly like the guy with the hiccups in The Simpsons. Kill me. Kill me.
Yep. Oh, man. I feel like him when I get hiccups all the time. But in this series, in Paradise X, Mephisto emerges as the true big evil. He manipulates the Asgardians. He unleashes a monstrous new type of death upon the planet. He kills and he lies and he just messes up everything for everyone who is still alive. On the opposite side of things, opposing Magneto, whether he knows it or not at each point, are Reed Richards, King Britain, which is Brian Braddock, aka Captain Britain, and a whole bunch of other heroes. Reed Richards' journey in Paradise X is very core to things, which I think is important because Alex Ross and Jim Kruger, Alex in particular, huge Fantastic Four fans, huge fans of that early days of the Marvel Universe. So using Reed here was very important. So Reed is trying to help those who can't die to go to paradise itself and confront Mar-Vell. There is a paradise. There is a whole thing that's going on, but we're trying to pull back, not spoil too much, because there's 50 plus issues in here. And I think it's a really fun journey for, you know, anybody who's listening, who's like, I need a lot of comics to read. This is the time to do it.
And the sort of final piece to this so far is Marvel's X, which is kind of a great marriage between the idea of Marvel's and Earth X series, because it has the perspective of Marvel's from a more human point of view. And then you have the alternate universe factor of Earth X.
Yeah, so it is a true prequel to Earth X, but from the sort of POV human perspective of Marvel's. And it's going on right now. I think the third or the fourth issue is has just been released. So I would definitely say check it out. It's got like little hints about how we get to the events of Earth X, but providing a really wonderful ground level look at everything going on. I do want to give a special shout out to Zachary and Persia for helping take my nightmare of notes, my like 10,000 words or whatever I wrote about this and hammering it into something that makes a lot more sense for the podcast. But if you do want to read all my nonsense, we're going to put that up on marvel.com where I do a deeper breakdown of all the things happening. That'll be up on the site. And big thanks to Jamie Frevely for helping shepherd that along.
This episode of This Week in Marvel was produced by Persia Verlin, Zachary Goldberg, Ryan Penagos, and Lorraine Sink. Our audio development manager is Brad Barton. Jill DeBoff is our director of audio. And special thanks to the Watchers. Do you like to watch? Maybe you should be a Watcher. Apply on the moon.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Lorraine.
And this is Marvel.
Your universe.